Nice.
Okay, set up. Could I have the entry of appearances, please, on People versus Rodriguez?
Your Honor, this is Joseph Michael, Attorney Registration Number 40403, for the People, with the Attorney Registration Number 4855.
Chief Gaetano, Vice President of Public Defender's Office, on behalf of Mr. Rodriguez, I have the case.
Thank you. This case is set for only 30 minutes. Each side has 15 minutes as a result. Mr. Michael, please keep tracking your time.
Good morning again. Once again, for the record, my name is Joseph Michaels, Attorney Registration Number 40403. The remand resolution is abundantly appropriate here because for neither juror did the trial court ultimately make an appropriate three-step finding. More to the point, the Court of Appeals explicitly held that the findings were inadequate to support the trial court's ultimate rejection of the Batson challenges. Inadequate is something that can be cured. Inadequate means a remand to further establish the findings, to further establish the rulings. But what inadequate does not mean automatically is error. Like with the previous case, this case is not about an automatic reversal. It's about the road the courts have to take to get there. And it's about the defendant establishing purposeful racial discrimination. Before we get to reversal, under any certain set of circumstances, under a long set of jurisprudence from this court, you have to have proper trial court findings. In the absence of proper findings, there is absolutely no benefit to automatically sending back for a new trial. It doesn't protect Batson, it doesn't protect the challenged juror, and it doesn't protect the community at large or the integrity of the judicial system. I think I'd like to root my conversation in the juror's challenge here, particularly the juror A, who was challenged based off her questionnaire. I don't intend to spend a lot of time with juror B, primarily because opposing counsel essentially conceded that the findings for juror D were insufficient to merit even a stage three finding, and therefore juror D alone should go back to the trial court, that the Court of Appeals was wrong in its holding that juror D required a kind of reversal. Juror A wrote on her questionnaire that I cannot be a fair juror because of my religious beliefs. There were a couple other jurors who wrote something similar on their questionnaires, one of whom was struck and one of whom was never called to the 12 and never had a chance to be struck one way or another. When the prosecution challenged juror A, the prosecution noted the questionnaire and basically said this person can't be fair, has stated a very strong preference for it. And the court made absolutely no findings besides saying that was a statement on appeal. If not, I'm at fault. There are two problems with that. The first, of course, being that there are no findings. Under step three, you have to make a finding, you have to address potentially the reason, the demeanor of the prosecutor, the credibility of the prosecutor, stuff we talked about in the first argument. But the other problem is the court saying that was a statement on appeal, if not it's my fault, essentially shifts the burden away from the moving party, away from, in this case, the prosecutor, to the defendant. All that the defendant had to say is that didn't work I think there's a Batson challenge here, and after the prosecution is articulated the race neutral reason, the prosecutor is the one who bears the error because the trial court hasn't made any findings. So reversing with an absence of findings, or reversing because of an insufficient or ineffective trial court analysis under step three, essentially puts the onus on the person who originally made the peremptory strike. The rule requiring the prosecutor to talk with every juror or the defendant to talk with every juror they want to strike is unworkable. Voir dire is very fast. There's a time limit on it. In this case, it was 20 to 30 minutes, according to very early on in the transcript. They talk about how much time to give. And so you have to focus on the issues that you want to get across, rooting out who you think can be a fair juror and who you think is a juror that would be favorable to your case, obviously for non-discriminatory purposes. If you have a juror who unambiguously states, "I can't be fair," on the questionnaire, it's very hard to rationalize and certainly to impose a rule on a prosecutor or a defense counsel to say, you have to talk to that person in order to dismiss them. Because that essentially amounts to a waste of time. Especially when, as in this case, we're talking about a juror who said, my religion is going to interfere with my ability to be fair. The problem with that is, as we all know, religion can be a very divisive and a very inflammatory topic. So if a prosecutor or a defense counsel, but if an attorney gets up and says, now you wrote on your questionnaire your religion will prohibit you from being fair, can I change your mind about that? Then all of a sudden we get sidetracked onto this whole other issue of, oh, the prosecutor is beating up this juror because of religion, or let's have a theological discussion about sitting in judgment of other people, and all of a sudden your 20 or 30 minutes get away from you and from your ability to conduct a meaningful voir dire that will result in a jury that is acceptable to all parties and one that is fair and impartial. It also risks immediately for the attorney challenging that juror to have lost the entire jury panel before the trial even gets underway, because it could suggest that they're trying to impose a will or impose a belief system that is contrary to what the juror would say. And it could simply just completely eviscerate the whole idea of a discussion based on the merits of the case and talk about instead a belief system that may or may not comport with the judicial system. The other thing that I think is important is there's no requirement for rehabilitation under peremptory challenges. Now, under challenges for cause, in order to sustain a challenge for cause, you certainly have to try to rehabilitate and see if the juror will stick by their guns, stick by their morals. But here, we have a juror who says, I can't do it. My religious beliefs are going to interfere with this. There's no requirement that the prosecution turn around and say, well, are you sure? Can I change your mind? Or maybe if X, Y, and Z circumstances apply. That's just not necessary.
What do you make of the trial court statement, apparently I don't expect another Hispanic name to be turned down? Did I see that wrong?
You did not see that wrong. There was one black juror, who I believe was Juror D, and then Juror A was the Hispanic juror. And I don't think it was anything more than, if that does happen, then yes, there's clearly a problem with a pattern. I don't think there's a pattern here. I think it's the trial court simply giving a colloquial warning, not to suggest that it disbelieved the prosecutor, but that it didn't want to see a pattern. And that's part of the other problem, is that the trial court, through both Juror D and a little bit with Juror A, is looking at this through the eyes of, you have to establish a pattern in order to have discrimination. And that by itself is a legally incorrect conclusion anyway. You don't need to have more than one minority or more than one race or more than one gender excluded to create an offense to Batson. But the trial court thought you did. And so that also is a problem in terms of the step three analysis and the step three conclusions of Batson, and all the more reason, frankly, that at worst a remand is appropriate, but certainly not an outlier the first time.
Could I try to pin you down just a little bit on when you think a remand? It seems to me that may be the essential part of this case, when that's required rather than a, whether we call it structural error or whatever, but a reversal. Would you say that the only situation in which a reversal is required is if the trial judge made a clearly erroneous finding that that there were race-neutral reasons?
I think the record has to unambiguously demonstrate that there was a racial motivation, or a gender motivation, of course, behind the strike.
So it's not just a question of the judge having the law wrong, misunderstanding the standards.
I think if the judge has the law wrong, there's a possibility that the judge ruled incorrectly. But a judge ruling incorrectly one way or another on a Batson doesn't mean a whole lot if the standard that the judge imposes is incorrect.
If the prosecutor did not give a race-neutral reason, would that be grounds for reversal or sending it back down?
If I understand your question correctly, if the prosecution doesn't give any reason and the judge goes from the prima facie statement by the defendant to then to
I'm just trying to flesh out. It seems to me there are a lot of ways in which there could be an error on a Batson ruling. And I'm not sure when you think it goes back to give them another try and when it would actually be a reversal. Let's say the prosecutor gives a reason, but the appellate court finds that would not be a race-neutral reason. Just as, and give me that as an example of something that could go wrong. But the trial judge erroneously finds it is, and that was the appropriate, and that was the reason.
I think part of it depends on how thorough the trial court's findings are, what their credibility determination is, and what's actually said in the context. In my view, an automatic reversal only occurs in a very minimal cases. I think the preference should be a remand if there's any confusion.
What if the defendant makes a prima facie case as far as the appellate court is concerned, but the trial judge didn't think that and therefore didn't allow it to proceed past step one? Would that be a reversal?
Under current case law, that would be a remand, because then if the prima facie case is made, the prosecution has to have a chance to rebut it. And then it goes on to a discussion under step three of whether or not the prosecution's reason was race neutral and whether the defendant...
And so do I understand kind of the controlling principle for you is whether the prosecution is being unfairly punished? And if it would be because of the judge's error, then it has to go back?
I think that is certainly one of the bigger points to be made. I don't think the presumption should be for reversal. I think the presumption should be for making a correct finding and for making sure that the record supports either the trial court's finding about the prosecution's credibility or flatly rejects it. We're not talking about a mistake or simply being confused about the facts or there being this gray area. The standard that's constantly invoked with reversal is you have to look at the record and have this definite and firm belief that a mistake has been made. And I don't think we have that in any of these three cases, or any of the three jurors in front of us today, and certainly not in these two cases, and certainly not in Wilson. The fact that we spent a half hour talking about what the prosecution's motive might have been suggests that. Here we have a very specific statement from the juror questionnaire saying, I can't do it. Or in juror D's case, I'm not the best juror. It's too easy to make it to mistake my identity. And those are pretty strong statements in favor of a reason to dismiss that juror. I think the real crux that we want to look at is when we're talking about, maybe think about it as a procedural versus a substantive error. With the procedural, that's an error. We have either an error in the analysis, so either an inadvertent or inapplicable controlling legal precedent is applied, or there just aren't sufficient findings, or there isn't sufficient record support, or the record is frankly unclear. In those cases, I think a remand is helpful with the instruction that trial court, if you find that the prosecution's reasons can't be sustained, then you go back to square one. But the only time an appellate court should be automatically reversing is when there's this substantive error, where the ruling is manifestly wrong, contradicted by the record. It should be a very small number of cases, or else the idea is people will invoke Batson, not necessarily for the purpose of protecting Batson, but for to win appellate.
That's not when you said automatically reversing. That sort of raises the structural error problem, but it seems to me what you're arguing is the appellate court shouldn't even be deciding whether the error was harmful or not. It should be remanding for another determination.
I think in the majority of cases, a remand is the more appropriate outcome. I don't want to ever say never, because there are certainly cases, and quite a few of the U.S. Supreme Court cases, I would direct this court to review Snyder and both the Miller L cases, and of course Batson, and Perquet all talk about very specific and Hernandez all talk about very specific reasons that are flatly contradicted by the record, not just, well, the record might have said this or might have said this, or there might have been a reason we don't know because we don't have the findings. there are very clear reasons in those cases about why rehearsal is appropriate. And the crux is, it has to be racially motivated. There has to be, you have them saying, look, I'm excusing this juror because of their race, because of their gender. Whatever it is, it can't just be, there is a reason in the record, in the facts, that is maybe ambiguous, so therefore we're going to default to thinking that it's a reason due to race. I'm going to save you 27 seconds for rebuttal if you don't mind.
Good morning. May it please the court. When the government's choice of jurors is tainted with racial bias, that overt wrong casts doubt over the obligation of the parties, the jury, and indeed the court to adhere to the law throughout the trial. That's what the United States Supreme Court said of Batson errors in Miller L. v. Dredge. There are a few select cases which require automatic reversal when certain errors occur. These errors, structural error, are errors which affect the framework within which the trial proceeds. They're errors determined to be of such importance with unquantifiable and indeterminate consequences that we have determined that they render the trial process itself fundamentally unfair. Batson errors are ascribed to status. It's acknowledged as much in Rivera v. Illinois. It's acknowledged as much in Dawson v. Delaware. And there are numerous cases throughout the United States that hold such, all cited within my brief. The very narrow question before this court is whether the Court of Appeals should have remanded for a new trial, or it should have remanded for a new Batson hearing in this case. And it appears that we're all in agreement, at least from the briefing in my case, that after a Batson error has occurred, meaning an error resulting after a court proceeds through the three steps of the required analysis, and it's determined that the prosecutor's use of a peremptory challenge was racially motivated, that structural error results, requiring reversal. Now, I want to talk about the facts of my case, a couple of things. I want to respond, first of all, to the juror D concession that the state alleges. And I just want to point out that I'm not conceding juror D. However, with juror A, it was obvious that the court had gone through the three-step Batson analysis. And we went through the three steps. The first two steps are reviewed de novo. The third step is reviewed for clear error. And that's the court's acceptance of the prosecutor's proffered race-neutral reason for the exercise of the challenge. And that's why we're talking about whether the record supports the proffered reason. And in this case, the record did not support the proffered race-neutral reason. Juror A had responded on a juror questionnaire to a question that asked, do you have any concerns about your ability to be fair? And let me just cite it. Is there any reason you believe you could not be fair in a juror or as a juror in a criminal case? That was the question. And the juror responded, because of my religious beliefs. It did not indicate why, against whom it might have prejudice, how it would make that juror believe that she could be unfair. There were no questions asked of this juror. And indeed, at the very beginning, the court asked the parties if it was sufficient that they give or that they receive 20 minutes. No additional time was requested by the prosecutor below. The prosecutor went through, the trial court itself went through statements of law and asked if any of the jurors had any problem with applying the principles of law that it went through. And no juror responded that it had any problem. No questions were asked of juror A, and indeed, the prosecutor didn't ask for additional time when it ended its questioning. It was not told that it had to stop. It was not told that it had 5 minutes, the prosecutor had 5 minutes longer and had to discontinue asking questions. There was no indication that there was any need for additional time or that this happened so quickly that the prosecutor was unable to ask any questions. And indeed, both parties went through the questionnaire at the beginning of voir dire, and the trial court asked if they had any challenges for cause. A juror's statement, if you believe that it's problematic, they indicate that they can't be fair because of their religious beliefs, should be raised at that time. It was not. In this case, there was no reason to believe that that reason given by the prosecutor, that it was striking juror A because of that respondent juror questionnaire, was for the legitimate reason. And when you look at the context of this case, the record was developed. That was the only proper race-neutral reason. It occurred in a case in which the complainant, the alleged victim in this case, was overtly racist. He continued throughout the trial using significant racial slurs that I won't repeat here, they're cited in the brief. Referring to my client, those people, I know that how they are. Very offensive language. This was a racially charged case. So it's not surprising that the prosecutor in this case wanted to remove all of the people of color. That's what was happening. That's why it raised the challenge as to juror A or juror D first, why the defense raised the challenge, and then why we raised it again as to juror A. The trial court then went through the three-step analysis. We made a sufficient prima facie case. We said the prosecutor is attempting to strike all the people of color. This particular juror A has a Hispanic surname. My client is Hispanic. And this is a racially motivated or racially charged case. The burden then shifted to the prosecutor in my case, and the prosecutor advanced that response on the questionnaire as the sole reason. The trial court responded by saying, well, that should sustain on appeal. If not, it's my fault. But I better not see any more Hispanic surnames. I believe that we're establishing a pattern now. The totality of this record and these circumstances clearly evidences that this strike was racially motivated. That's why the Court of Appeals reversed for a new trial. It was sufficiently established under well-established case law that when you go through the three-step analysis and the record is sufficiently developed, it requires automatic reversal.
Could I interrupt and ask a question? Given what the prosecutor gave for a reason, do you believe that was a race-neutral reason and required moving on to the third step?
It arguably is a race-neutral reason. The defendant then responded, as we have an opportunity to, and indicated you didn't ask any questions of that juror regarding that response, and indeed didn't ask her any questions at all.
If the court, given the situation exactly as it is, but rather than indicating that the court probably had the test wrong and had just said, yes, I believe the prosecutor, that religious reason is plenty good and that's race neutral, and therefore I deny the Batson challenge, would that have, do you believe, been subject to reversal and appeal?
That's essentially what did happen. You're saying if he didn't make the erroneous statements regarding the pattern as well? Yes, that could be subject to reversal as well, absolutely. And so, that's because the record belied that assertion, because the prosecutor hadn't asked any questions of the juror. And under Miller, L.B. Dredke, Gabler, O'Shaughnessy, the courts have set forth the standard, which is that if the questions aren't asked concerning the articulated race-neutral reason for excusing a juror, that raises the inference that it was contextual.
Pat?
Please.
Where does Miller L. say that? I know Gabler, however it's pronounced, says that. But where can you quote that language in a decision of the United States Supreme Court or this court? And maybe I just missed it.
Mm-hmm. It's at, let's see, 246. And it begins with a paragraph, it would be difficult to credit the state's new explanation, which reeks of afterthought. And it indicates, citing to an Alabama case, the state's failure to engage in any meaningful voir dire examination on a subject the state alleges it is concerned about is evidence suggesting that the explanation is a sham and a pretext for discrimination.
Is that the same as creating an inference? Does it go as far as the Gabler-Gabler language? Which is the Court of Appeals, of course.
You know, I think it depends on the totality of the circumstances. Again, and I think this is what you were discussing in terms of that third step. What are we to look at? I don't think that courts are required to find one way or another based solely on that fact. It reads merely that it suggests that it's a pretext. And in the context of other factors, for example, being in the middle of a racially charged or racially motivated setting, that the prior juror had just been excused was a person of color, that there were no other jurors, with the exception of one, who had a Hispanic surname or any name indicating that they were belonged to any minority group. At that point, I think that the court can adequately review the record, go through the three steps as the trial court did, and determine that it's appropriate to remand for a new trial because this is structural error, and the proper reasons are not supported by the record. And that's what amounts to clear error in that third step of Batson analysis.
Thank you.
So essentially, I want to reiterate that I agree that on one hand there are procedural errors. These are the types of cases in which we have seen reversals and remands for a new Batson hearing. But that's generally where the court has only reached step one and has not gone further and has made an erroneous determination that no prima facie case has been established, for example, or has made an erroneous finding at step two and hasn't moved on. When the record is fully developed and there's enough for the reviewing court to determine that an exercise of peremptory was racially motivated, that's where we require reversal. And the facts of this case demonstrate when that's warranted. Because here we have two jurors. One, if it were just juror D, and that's all we were dealing with, it may have been appropriate to just remand back for another Batson hearing. But that's not what we have here. We have two jurors. And we have one where the record is fully developed, one where the court did go through the three-step Batson analysis, and the other juror, they stopped the prima facie case when the trial court told the defense attorney that there's been no pattern and to stand back.
Ms. Vice, good morning. Do you know in the record, does it state anywhere what the racial makeup of the jury was? I mean, we rely so much on surnames, and I think that's sort of a perilous journey, but is there any indication in there about the racial makeup of the jury?
There is not. There was no observation by the trial court. Now, of course, that was something that the trial court could have done. Again, that third step of Batson is left relatively open. There was no record made concerning skin color, the racial composition by way of viewing and that sort of thing. We can tell from the jury record the last names of the jurors who actually ended up serving. There appears to be one person with a Hispanic surname. The rest, it appears to be that they're primarily Caucasian names.
The reason I bring that up is the judge seems to believe that there needs to be a pattern established under that first step, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So was his comment, there better not be another Hispanic surname, was that indicative that it was racially motivated, or was that indicative that I'm going to find a pattern? Or can we tell?
I don't think that we can necessarily tell. I just want to hit on quickly the fact that remanding this case, or these types of cases, 5 years after the fact, for a determination of the credibility of the prosecutor, for the racial composition, or the appearance of the various jurors, 5 years later, is an impossible feat. It really would be a legal fiction, I think, in that instance, to believe that they can make the appropriate findings when the court is not oriented in the first instance to those findings that are required under Batson. When it's making the original Batson determination.
Doesn't the Carlson, is it Carlson, the Med-Mal case cut against that?
I think that case is distinguishable, Your Honor, and this is why. The Craig v. Carlson case is a civil case. Of course, the Batson errors touch on the defendant's equal protection rights to a trial by a jury of their peers not selected via discriminatory methods, for example. That touches on the Sixth Amendment right, and that's specific to criminal defendants. If you look at both the United States constitutional amendment as well as Colorado Section 23 of Article 2. So I would say that Craig v. Carlson is distinguishable on that ground, as well as the fact that that was a subsequent court making or holding a Batson hearing that is supported by the record. The court in that case, which was 3 months after the original trial, was able to make a determination of the credibility of the prosecutor based on the fact that the prosecutor's articulated reasons for the race for exercising the peremptory were supported by the record, with the exception of one arguable factor, but otherwise every other reason that the prosecutor offered for each of the three jurors, I believe, that were subject in that case was supported by the record. So the subsequent court was well suited to make that determination. And I do see that I'm out of time. I would ask the court to please affirm the Court of Appeals' opinion.
Thank you. Mr. Michaels?
Very briefly, at the time of voir dire, an attorney does not know what juror is going to be challenged under Batson. So the idea is that they have to make as many factual determinations about the juror as they can. Gabler needs to be distinguished, and in that case, there were three problems. The prosecution didn't talk to the jurors at all, the alleged reasons were directly refuted by the record, and he qualified the white jurors. We don't have that here. And last but not
all right, thanks, counsel, for your arguments. We appreciate it. The court is going to now be in recess.